Good morning. Good to see y'all. We are continuing our study this morning of Christianity 101, Basics of the Faith, and we come this morning to one that I think causes a lot of struggles for people, and that is the doctrine that the Scriptures teach on every page of the absolute sovereignty of God over all things, and that's what we're going to investigate here this morning briefly. I want to open up with one of my favorite quotes of all time about this from Thomas J. Stonewall Jackson. Some of y'all remember him. He was a great general during the Civil War. What you may not know about him, a couple things. He taught the first African-American Sunday school class in the history of the state of Virginia. In fact, on the night that he received his famous nickname, there stands General Jackson like a stone wall. He and his generals were celebrating, and they were just lauding all of this praise on him, and he turned ghost-faced and left his tent without explanation, just said, "Excuse me, gentlemen," and went and left. And people wondered if something had happened, if they'd said something. Turns out he had forgotten to send his Sunday school offering to his pastor back in Virginia, and he was mortified that he'd forgotten to give his tithe that day. So he sat down and wrote a letter to his pastor and said, "Please forgive me for that." All that to say, he was a devoutly religious man. He was a Presbyterian deacon his entire life until he died. And here's what he said when somebody asked him about his bravery. He said, "My religious belief teaches me to feel as safe in battle as in bed. God has fixed the time for my death. I do not concern myself about that, but to be always ready, no matter when it may overtake me. This is the way all men should live, and then all men would be equally brave." Why do I cite that? Because here's a guy who saw a lot of action in battle and understood the implications of the doctrine of the sovereignty of God for his everyday life. And the reason this doctrine can be hard for us is because of all the bad stuff we see in the world. He saw a lot of it on the battlefield. But Callie and I watched the other night, and it kind of hit home for me, the movie 22 July. Some of y'all may know what that's about. It's about the terrorist attacks in Norway on the 22nd of July, 2011, in which a terrorist blew up a bomb in front of the government building in Oslo and then drove to an island where there was a youth camp and killed upwards of 59 teenagers, and then took the lives of about 18 others in his bomb blast in Norway, in Oslo. The reason it hit home for me is that was the summer we were up in Philadelphia. I was doing my graduate work at Westminster, and part of that was taking classes at Temple University. And at Temple that semester, I was in a couple of philosophy courses with two Norwegian professors that were visiting from Europe at that time to teach these courses, and both of them knew multiple victims of that attack. They were sons and daughters of these professors' friends. It was a husband and wife team that taught these courses I took. And they were thoroughly atheists. They were thoroughly secularized, like most of Norway. And they had no conceptual resources to deal with this tragedy. They were hurting. And there was no comfort. There was no answer. Why did this happen? And I remember this brilliant professor trying to struggle to answer that question to this class full of PhD hopefuls in philosophy at a great university. And just sitting here listening to her, not being able to make sense. And so here's why I say all that. This doctrine will test you like few others. This doctrine will let you know what you really believe about the Scriptures and about the Christian faith. Let's jump into it. Here's the biblical basics of the doctrine of the sovereignty of God. First, what the Bible teaches on every page is that God is sovereign over every detail of the universe. Psalm 115:3, our God is in the heavens. He does whatever He pleases. Why? Isaiah 48:11, for my own name's sake, I do it. My glory I will not give to another. Matthew 10:30, even the hairs of your head are numbered. And we lose, you doctors and scientists in here can give me the exact number, I'm sure, but we lose, some of us more than others, a lot of hair each year. A lot of hair falls from our heads. Millions of strands of hair from billions of people. And Jesus says, God knows every one of them. He knows all of our hairs. That's the minute detail with which He manages the creation He made. He's sovereign over every detail of the universe. He's sovereign over every detail of our lives and of our deaths. Deuteronomy 32, 39. Here's what Moses is saying to the people of Israel as he's giving this final farewell sermon. He says this. He's talking, this is the Lord speaking through Moses. See now that I, even I am he, and there is no God beside me. I kill and I make alive. I wound and I heal, and there is none that can deliver out of my hand. And then you turn over to a place like 1 Samuel 2:6, where Hannah has her prayer answered for a little baby. And Hannah's a young girl, probably about 13, 14 years old. It's weird, I know, but that was Bible times. Don't read too much into that. That's just how it was. Mary was probably the same age. They got married a lot younger because they only lived till about age 30 at that time. But she's sitting there praying after she gets a son, and she knew her Psalter well, because she starts praying this prayer back to God and says, "You make rich and you make poor. You kill and you make alive." What is she saying? God, you are sovereign over my life, over my death, over my baby, over everything. And then you get to a place like Acts 17:26, where Paul is speaking to a non-Jewish audience, the Harvard of his day, the Areopagus, the place where in Athens all the great intellects gather. And they summon Paul in front of them to make fun of him. They say babblers, our English translation. In the Greek, it's seed picker. You're a little bird pecking for scraps, Paul. Come tell us something. And he stands up before this pagan audience and says, there's a God. And here's what he says, Acts 17:26, who determined all their boundary places and dwellings. Talking about every human being. He determines all our boundary places and dwellings, everything about our lives. That's Paul's point to that audience. And then we see all over the place. I just have this one here from Ephesians 2:8-10. For it's by grace you are saved by faith, and this not of yourselves. It is the gift of God, not of works, lest any man should boast. For we are his workmanship in Christ Jesus, created for good works, which were prepared for us before the foundation of the world. And then if you went back to Ephesians 1:3-14, we studied that last week. Very huge statement on God's absolute sovereignty over our salvation. He's sovereign over every detail of our lives, our life and death, and our salvation. Here's the tough one. Here's the one that we can all kind of nod and go, okay, that's awesome, that's kind of comforting. Then we get here. That God is sovereign over evil. And the number one question I have gotten since I became a Christian, let alone the ministry, is how can you believe in a God who is sovereign when there's so much wrong with this world? When there's, like this movie we watched, kids playing soccer, and then some twisted guy dressed up as a policeman comes and starts picking them off with a high caliber rifle. Or babies that get cancer and die before they turn 2 or 3 years old. And you have to watch a little child suffer. That's what does it for me. That's where the questions come rushing in for me. Why would God let children suffer? Or you think about the massive problem right now around the world, in our city, in our country, in our state, of human trafficking. Little girls and little boys are kidnapped, drugged, forced to do unspeakable things. And we want to say, where are you, God? Why would you do it this way? And when we ask that question, we get answers back like 2 Samuel 7:14. Let me read that for you very quickly. About God's sovereignty. It says, I will be to him a father. Oh, I'm sorry, I got the wrong verse in there. My bad. Let's go to Isaiah 47. I got the wrong Samuel reference. This is even stronger. Here's what God says. I'm going to translate it from what he wrote, the literal translation. We kind of gloss it over in the English. I form light and create darkness. I make well-being and create calamity. I am the Lord who does all these things. And that word for calamity is evil. Hebrew word ra. It's translated evil almost every other time in the Old Testament. I create evil. What do we do with that? How do we worship a God like that? And that Acts verse I want to come back to in just a second, but that verse that from Isaiah is not a stray verse. It's all over the place in the Scriptures. What do we do with it? How do we worship a God who says things like that? And I think what Jesus would say to us this morning is this. I think he would say, do you think that me coming makes this God any different? And I think he would say to us, no. Because Jesus is the one who taught us about God's sovereignty over every detail of our lives. And Jesus is the one, Acts 2:23, who comes and it's said about him in Peter's sermon. What does Peter say there? He says, let's just read it together so I don't misquote it. Acts 2:23, here's what Peter says to the crowd when he's preaching the first Christian sermon. This Jesus delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God. Pause. God is sovereign over good and evil. What's the most evil thing that ever happened in the history of the human race? We could point to the Holocaust. We could point to the gulags of Russia. We could point to the killing fields of Pol Pot. We could point to the massive genocide in Rwanda or Bosnia. We could go to all these things. But the most evil act that ever took place on the history of this planet and in the history of the human race was the crucifixion of the innocent, sinless Son of God. That's the greatest crime ever perpetuated by humanity. Here's what Peter says. Jesus delivered up, and he piles the terms on. Definite plan, foreknowledge of God. Not an accident, not an afterthought. Evil doesn't get the last word. Plan, foreknowledge, God did it all. That's Peter's point. Then notice what he says. You crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men. And here's where, when we talk about God's sovereignty over evil, we want to stop and say, wait a minute, Peter. Wait a minute. Which one is it? Is it definite plan and foreknowledge or lawless man with wicked hands that crucified him? And I think Peter would say to us, yes. Yes. I think Jesus would say to us, yes, it's both and. And then the question's always going to be, well, if God is sovereign over evil, and yet we're responsible for this evil, which is our next point here, if that's the case, how do you bring those two together? How are we still responsible for our sin? And here's the Bible's answer to that. It doesn't give us the answer we want. It doesn't tell us the exact outworkings of how that comes together. It holds those two truths in tension. And here's what you have to do if you're reading the Scriptures. You see all these passages, I've cited a handful, we could go for hundreds more, of God being absolutely sovereign. And then you've got these passages that say, yet we're responsible for our sin. God will hold us to account for our sin. And you try to say, how do we bring those together? And the Bible doesn't give us a detailed answer. It simply holds them in tension. And then the other answer we could give at this point, why would God have so much evil? And I was just reading in Exodus 14 this morning, and this is a repetition of what he told them before the Exodus. But God says, Moses, I want you to part the Red Sea. That's a calling. Okay, how'd you like to wake up in the morning, get you a little breakfast, and go part a sea? Okay, he says, I'm going to be with you. I'm going to do it. And I'm going to do it, and I'm going to harden Pharaoh's heart so he won't listen. And he'd said that before. And then you read, and Pharaoh hardened his own heart. And then you read, and God hardened Pharaoh's heart. And you want to go, which one is it, God? And he says, yes. And then he tells us at the end why he did what he did in taking the lives of countless Egyptian soldiers. He says, for my glory I have done this. Okay? Here's the test for us, where this stops being a theological debate and starts putting boots on the ground. Will we bow the knee and worship when we don't understand? How does God get more glory in doing it this way than in another way? I don't know. He doesn't tell us. He says, trust me. We talked a little bit about this last week. This is the hard part of this doctrine, y'all. Because nothing, no doctrine, I think, is more calculated to be on a collision course with every cultural assumption around us than the doctrine of the sovereignty of God. Because everything around us in this country and in our lives tells us we're free. We can do whatever we want. The possibilities are endless. And God says, no, they're not. And I do things you will never understand. And I do them in a way that we will never understand. And it's all for my purposes and my glory. And you don't get to know all the answers. And you've got to be okay with that. Because I love you. That's what he says to us. And I'll hold you. And let me say this as we move on just to some application here. What does it mean for Monday? God's sovereignty and understanding it should be a source of freedom for us, true freedom. And I listed a couple things it should free us from. It should free us from worry. And I'm talking as someone who is a chronic worrier. But do you know what anxiety is? Anxiety is a heart screaming at you that God is not sovereign. That's what it is. When we worry, we're saying, I've got to do something. I've got to take this situation into my own hands and figure it out. And what the doctrine of God's absolute sovereignty tells us is, no, you don't. That he's planned it all. And I'm just putting it out there. I don't know how you make it through life without thinking like this. Okay? I remember right after Hurricane Katrina, a well-meaning person said to me, said, you know, God had nothing to do with Katrina. He wasn't there. Now, we had friends in Jackson who lost houses in New Orleans, who had family in New Orleans that were just gone after Katrina. We could multiply the examples. It doesn't have to be Katrina. It could be what happened here in the flood, what happened in Tallahassee in the panhandle recently in Florida. And if you tell somebody who's been through something like that, God wasn't there, I don't know how that's comforting. If God wasn't there, then the flood's stronger than God. The storm's stronger than God, and he's not really God then. He's an idol. The God of the Bible says, all these things are in my hand. David prayed that to him. You are my God. My times are in your hands. And if you suffer like I do from being a chronic worrier, and why are we worriers in our society? Because everything around us tells us you need to be in control. And online banking apps and security systems and everything else gives us the illusion of control. I can check my garage. I can look at my house. I can look at my business. I have control in the palm of my hands, and that's all an illusion, isn't it? We don't know what's going to happen. We don't know if all of us are going to be here next week. Think about it that way. Some of us in this room have lived most of our lives. Some of us have a long way to go. But some of us in this room have lived at this point right now most of our lives. And that will cause you racking anxiety and racking fear unless you believe what the scriptures just showed us, that even the worst thing that ever happened was in the hands and plan of God, and what men meant for evil, God used for good in the cross. That's where we rest. That's why it's good news, because nothing overcomes his plan, and he will eventually defeat death and anxiety and worry. And we live in a restored creation where none of that matters anymore. It frees us from fear of risk for God's kingdom. We are afraid to risk for God. And I'm afraid to risk for God. I love comfort. That's one of my idols. I want to be comfortable. I don't want to take risks for the kingdom. But our prayer ought to be for our kids and for the children of this church that God raises up fearless missionaries. Because there's a lot of unevangelized people in the world right now. And it's going to take brave missionaries to go carry the gospel to them. And that may be some of you. Some of you may be called by God, not all of you, but some of you may be called by God to do crazy things, like sell a business and go to the mission field. Maybe. You'll know when He calls. You'll have the support of everybody in this church if you do that, I can guarantee you. But at some level, we all of us are going to take a risk for the kingdom, whether it's walking across the street or taking a plane across the world. And when we know God is sovereign, we don't have to worry about what's going to happen with those results. We just obey. We just go where He tells us to go. So it frees us from fearing risk, and whether it's just witnessing to a neighbor or a coworker, or whether it's saying, I feel called like I've never been called in my life to go to a closed country and share Jesus. I love what Mark Dever said about that. He says, there are really no closed countries in this world. There's just countries where it's more difficult to preach your second sermon. That's right. And the third thing it will do, it'll give us the freedom from concerns about the future. Don't we all worry about that? The economy, our kids, if we're going to have kids, if we're ever going to get married, what about our grandkids? What about this church? What about this city? What about our home values? Just that the list could be multiplied. What about work? Am I going to have a job? What about money? Do I have enough? Have I saved enough? And all of those things can come flooding in for the acid in the stomach and the sleepless nights. And what we all need help with, what I need help with, is to be reminded again and again, all of that's planned. He's in charge of all of it. He knows the hairs on my head, so therefore He knows the dollars in your bank accounts, the days of your lives, the work concerns, the children concerns, and He says, it's all mine. And I have promised, Hebrews 13, never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. I think I've quoted this before, that Samuel Rutherford, who's one of the great Puritan writers, helped write the Westminster Confession. He said this, when I am in the cellar of affliction, there I find my Lord's choicest wines. That's some good language right there. When I'm in the cellar of affliction, when I'm on my back from being in pain or sickness or cancer or worry, whatever it is, there I find God's best grace. This is where it gets real. I know people in here, and I know there's some that you haven't even shared with me. But there's, in a room this size, this many people, there's hurts that are unimaginable. Okay? There's things that have happened to you this week that you didn't see coming. And you wonder, is this really true? Is this book really true? And Jesus would say to us from the cross, yes. He would say to us from the cross, if this was part of God's plan, then whatever you're facing, that is part of God's plan. That's what He'd say to us, I think. And He would never just say that as like a doctrinal statement to get over whatever you're going through. It's not kind of like Jesus comes to us and goes, have you not memorized Romans 8:28? All things work for good. Have a blessed day. Just get that and have a blessed day. He doesn't do that. He holds us in those times. He draws near to us in those times. It reminds me of a story. Callie and I hosted a friend of mine who's now in the States. I want to get him here to speak. He was a leader in the underground church in Eritrea. Second worst country to be a Christian in the world. Third worst, I'm sorry, behind North Korea and Iran. He can't walk straight, because they beat him so many times that they broke parts of his back that never healed correctly because What they did was round up the evangelical pastors and put them in deserts around the country in shipping containers. Let him out 15 minutes a day. 6 times he endured that imprisonment. For 2 years he was separated from his family under death threats from the government. Couldn't arrive at church at the same time, had to hold church in an apartment because the government would kill Christians if they saw them all coming together. And he was sitting at my table in Greenville about 10 years ago. And you're listening to this guy speak, and Callie and I, it's just a different world, right? We don't know anything about that. And he said a couple things that just blew us both away. He said, I would go back to that shipping container tomorrow if it meant bringing Christianity to my people who I love, and because that's where I felt so close to God. He met me in that container every single day. Then the second thing he said is, I said, well, what do we do? And this is, he got kind of like a little angry, like passionate, but a little angry, kind of like looking at me going, hey, Mr. Theological Preacher Guy, you should know this. I said, well, like, what can we do to help you and bring you over here? He said, do you think I want here? You think I want the American dream? I don't want that. I want to go back and preach and see Eritrea come to know Christ. And he said, brother, don't you believe in the sovereignty of God? I said, of course I do. He said, then God put you in Greenville. He put me in Asmara. And don't complain. And don't worry. Just pray. I don't want your life. I don't want this life. I want to see people come to know Jesus in my country. That was humbling. Couple more things we finish up. God's sovereignty should renew our worship. He's the only God worthy of worship. If his hand doesn't have the storm, then the storm has the upper hand. You should be worshiping the storm, not God. But the God of the Bible is totally sovereign and therefore worthy of our worship. This should renew us when we go, I'm kind of bored. We should bow our knees and go, what kind of a God am I dealing with? He's so much greater than I ever imagined. So much nearer than I ever dreamed. So much more loving than I ever dared to hope. If the culmination of his sovereign plan is the cross, we can never doubt his love again. And if we can never doubt his love, then worship is sweet. You see, this is what the Bible does. It gives us a God who we are to fear but love. All the other gods of the world kind of make it easy in one sense to love them. They're just a little bit bigger than versions of us. Or they just fear no love like Allah because he's just about obedience. And when you have the gospel, you have love and fear. You have God calling us to both and giving us both in the gospel. We can come and worship him because of who he is. And then God's sovereignty should change how we view our material possessions. Isn't that what Hannah prayed? The Lord makes rich and he makes poor. Okay? I'm going to balance that with the Proverbs that tell us about diligence and hard work, and a good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children. And the Bible's not anti-wealth. Abraham was the wealthiest man of his generation. Solomon was the wealthiest man to ever live. Jesus had rich folk gather around him. Joseph of Arimathea. Okay? God's not anti-wealth. He is anti-worship of wealth. If you have money here today, he gave it to you. He can take it from us, and as John Piper says, he will have done us no wrong if he does that. The Lord gives the power to gain wealth, he told the Israelites. Don't get puffed up when you come into the promised land, he told them. It's all from me. And he does this, and one reason he does this is so that we share. Not forced communism. The Bible has no place for forced communism, ever. It does hold up for us generosity, freedom from the love of money, And I love what Piper says here. God gives us money to show us, to show with money, that Jesus is our treasure, not money. And you can apply that across the board. He gives us food to enjoy, to show that Jesus is our treasure, not food. He gives us sex to enjoy, to show us that Jesus is our treasure, and show the world that Jesus is our treasure, not sex, not money, not food. Whatever it is. But if we believe in the sovereignty of God, we'll risk with our wealth too. We have so many needs, don't we? For missionaries, local missions. And my great-grandparents, I've mentioned this before, were missionaries. My great-aunt and uncle were missionaries. And I was talking to their daughter, who's about 70 or 75 or so, lives out in Arizona. And she said, kingdom work gets done by wealth. That's how it happens. And this is why when I hear well-meaning a younger generation wanting to be all anti-wealth, how do you think kingdom work gets done without that? We need wealth creators. We need stewards of wealth. And we need to have Christians who understand that God's sovereign over their money so we can give it away more freely to missions, to outreach, to evangelism. If we don't do it, who will? And if we understand God is sovereign, money won't be our treasure, Jesus will be. And then the last thing, God's sovereignty should make us bold and fearless. Should make us bold and fearless. That was Jackson's point from that quote at the beginning. All men should believe this, then all would be equally brave. How do you get brave like that? When you know that God has determined your times and places. When you know that He holds the power of life and death in His hand, and that the moment we stop thinking that, the moment we've bought into the illusion that we're in control. And that's the struggle here. Is God sovereign over my life or am I? And the Bible answers on every page, we are not. And if this is true, and it is, then it makes us bold and fearless in our living and dying. Means we can have an answer when life gets really, really hard. You know, there's so many people we've walked with, and the ministry just magnifies this, of people who've suffered well for Jesus. Like my friend I mentioned from Eritrea, but people I've walked through who were in the prime of life, and got cancer, had a child kill himself, lost a spouse out of the blue. I think of an elder back in Jackson who's traveling to go to California for vacation. His wife dropped dead on the plane. Out of the blue. How do you deal with that? How do you go on? How's this guy still worshiping and serving and loving Jesus? And he'd tell you that it's because he knew God is sovereign and over all these things. And this is the only way to withstand the winter storms that are coming to our lives, y'all. Your winter storm is going to be different than mine. But the reason the Bible is so wonderful as a book is that it's so real. It tells us to live in hope even when it is very real about the fact that life is a lot more suffering than it is good times, right? We all know that from experience. And that will either make you live in worry and fear that the other shoe is going to drop and God is not a good God and He doesn't love you, or it will make you worship and say, even though I don't know what's coming, even though I don't know if it's going to be more awful than I could ever imagine, I know that God is over this. He has got me, and He will lead me safely home. That's Paul's reasoning in Romans 8, guys. Romans 8:28 is not an isolated statement. It culminates in Romans 8:39. It culminates in Paul saying, He who did not spare His only Son, how will He not also with Him freely give us all things? Therefore, the sovereignty of God makes us bold and fearless in living for Him, because if He didn't spare His Son and gave Him up for us, we can face life unafraid. The worst that could possibly happen, hell, death, judgment, already taken by Jesus. Therefore, we can live boldly and fearlessly. And there will come a time in my life and in yours when I need to be reminded of this. When I need to be told again these truths. When I need to practice what I preach. And when that time comes, God gives us each other to remind each other. God is sovereign, and He loves you. Amen.